Welcome to today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for May 18th, 2023. I am your reader, Martha Avery, and here's our first story from the front page. Feds, Iowa child labor rules break federal law. Governor hasn't yet signed bill into law. This is by Aaron Murphy of the Courier Des Moines Bureau. Des Moines, state labor rules for Iowa children in the workplace would be relaxed in a way that conflicts with federal regulations under legislation awaiting Governor Kim Reynolds' signature, the Federal Labor Department wrote in a letter published Wednesday by the State House Democrats. Republicans push back, saying some of the information in the letter is outdated because of changes made to the proposal during the legislative process, and because of what they say is a misinterpretation of the bill. The letter from the U.S. Department of Labor, dated May 10th, is a response to an inquiry letter sent March 14th by multiple Democrats in the legislature. In the letter, the Federal Labor Department says that Senate File 542, called the Youth Employment Bill by its supporters and Child Labor Bill by its opponents, has at least four provisions that would create labor standards for Iowa children that are lower than federal standards. Any employer that is allowed to Iowa children to work under those contrary terms contained in the state legislation would then be in violation of federal regulations. The Fair Labor Standards Act establishes federal standards with respect to child labor, and states cannot nullify federal requirements by enacting less protective standards, says the letter, signed by the Federal Labor Department Solicitor of Labor, Seema Nanda, and Wage and Hour Division Principal Deputy Administrator Jessica Luman. The bill would allow Iowa children to participate in work activities currently prohibited and work longer hours. It lets the State Workforce Department issue waivers to permit children to work under some circumstances that are currently prohibited and allow the Workforce or Education Department to grant exceptions for 16 and 17-year-olds to participate in work-based learning programs. The proposal was approved with only Republican support in the legislature. Reynolds has not yet taken action on the bill. Her office did not say Wednesday whether she will sign the legislation into law, only that she has until June 2nd to do so. Democrats and labor leaders argued the proposal would result in placing Iowa children in situations that would be dangerous to their health. This letter confirms what we've argued since this debate began. In a rush to expand child labor in Iowa, Republican legislators will be inviting businesses to break federal law, said Senator Nate Bolton, a Democrat from Des Moines, in a statement. Protections against unsafe and exploitive child labor are there for a reason, and failed measures to address Iowa's workforce crisis is no excuse to undermine those safeguards. The U.S. Labor Department letter also said it does not publish state-level active child labor investigation data, but said that the department currently has more than 600 such investigations underway nationwide, including in Iowa. With active child investigations underway in Iowa, now is not the time to put more kids at risk in dangerous working environments, Iowa Representative Jeff Kuhling, a Democrat from Cedar Rapids, and the party's top member of the House's Labor and Workforce Committee, said in a statement, while also calling for Reynolds to veto the bill. It's bad for Iowa kids, parents, and local Iowa businesses who may get fined. Republicans contested the conclusion reached by the Federal Labor Department and argued that many of Iowa's and other states' youth labor regulations already are out of step with federal regulations. One of the four provisions in the Iowa bill flagged by the Federal Labor Department no longer applies. One Republican spokesman said, because that part of the bill was altered before approval. The bill was amended to permit only those 16 and older to participate in the work-based learning programs, the spokesperson said. Another State House Republican spokesperson said that while the Labor Department's little notes that the federal law prohibits work in meat freezers, the legislation would permit only momentary work in meat freezers. Similarly, the spokesperson pushed back at the letter flagging a provision that allows 15-year-olds to apply for a waiver to perform light assembly work, provided it is not performed on or in an area with machines. Republicans argued during debate that Iowa youths currently are permitted to participate in athletic and other extracurricular activities that go well beyond the hours they are permitted to work. The next article from the front page is titled Event Remembers Officers' Sacrifice. Gathering reflects on Thanks Peace Officers Who Died in Line of Duty by Jeff Rennens, Waterloo. Residents and police officers, present and past, gathered to remember those who gave the ultimate sacrifice to protect the community on Wednesday. We all know that police are extremely important to us, that the protection of our freedoms in our community, of the ability to peacefully go about our work, needs protection, said Mark Nook, University of Northern Iowa president. But not every community takes time to reflect and thank and to honor those who engage in that service. The audience outside Veterans Memorial Hall included active police officers from across Black Hawk County, retired officers, and family members of those who died in the line of duty. UNI's police department organized the annual Peace Officers Memorial Service. Chiefs from local departments took turns reading the names of the fallen officers, a total of 14 since 1902, and the circumstances that led to their sacrifices. Last week, the FBI released a report outlining the line of duty deaths in 2022. According to the report, a total of 118 law enforcement officers were killed in line of duty incidents last year. Of these, 60 officers died as a result of criminal acts, a decrease of 17.8% when compared to the 73 officers who were killed as a result of criminal acts in 2021. Offenders used firearms to kill 49 of the 60 victim officers. Of the remaining officers, 3 were killed with vehicles used as weapons, and 8 were killed by punches and kicks, the report states. A total of 58 officers died in accidents in 2022. Of those, 35 died in vehicle crashes. 13 were pedestrian officers struck by vehicles. 6 officers were in the aircraft crash. 2 officers were killed in falls, and 2 died as a result of firearms-related incidents. According to the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund, 4 Iowa officers died in the line of duty in 2022. Michael Earl German, chief of the Prairie City Police Department, died January 13th of COVID-19 complications. Sergeant John Carl Williams of the Coralville Police Department died July 3rd after experiencing a chest pain while responding to a report of a shooting involving a toddler. Deputy Austin Wayne Richardson of the Fremont County Sheriff's Office died June 14th in a traffic accident. Deputy John Lawrence Grandpovnik of the Almaquy County Sheriff's Office died January 27th of COVID complications. And the last front page story is titled Penalty Hike on Fentanyl, Overdoses Becomes Law. Atlantic, Iowa. Iowa elected officials took action at the state and federal levels aimed at combating rising rates of fentanyl-related drug overdoses on Tuesday. Surrounded by state and local law enforcement, Reynolds signed the law in Atlantic, Iowa, where last year five area residents were arrested on federal charges in a fentanyl distribution case. In a fentanyl distribution case that led to a series of overdoses in Cass and Shelby counties. The law enhances the penalty for selling fentanyl, imposing up to 10 years of prison time for small amounts of the potent opioid and up to 50 years for more than 50 grams. The law will also triple the sentence otherwise imposed by law for providing a drug that results in someone's death, and double the sentence if it results in bodily injury. Manufacturing a drug in the presence of a minor or selling to a minor would carry twice the penalty otherwise imposed by law. This poison, and that's what it is, poison, is fueling addiction, death, and chaos, Reynolds, a Republican, said. The law proposed by Reynolds early in this year's legislative session is part of her push to put a spotlight on the rising presence of fentanyl in Iowa and its role in overdose deaths. Fentanyl, a potent opioid, about 100 times stronger than morphine, is often mixed into illicit pills pressed to look like other prescription medications and other drugs as a cost-cutting measure. Reynolds said Iowa law enforcement seized twice the number of fentanyl pills in 2022 than it did in 2021, and more than 27,000 in the last 6 weeks. Synthetic opioids like fentanyl accounted for more than 80% of all opioid-related overdoses nationally in 2020, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Iowa's rate of overdose deaths is among the lowest in the country, but it is increasing. In Iowa, 432 people died of drug overdoses in 2020, according to the CDC, and 172 of those, about 40%, were from synthetic opioids. A similar bill was proposed by Republican Attorney General Brenna Byrd at the beginning of this year's legislative session. Byrd said the law would allow prosecutors to seek stricter penalties at the state level when a person dies from drug overdose. This law brings the drug dealers who kill to justice, she said. It gives prosecutors the tools that we need to seek justice for the victims of crime and their families, and it prevents the scourge of the dangers of drugs in our communities. Under the new law, fentanyl sale and manufacture will be punished the following ways. Less than 5 grams, a Class C felony, punishable by up to 10 years in prison and a fine between $1,000 and $50,000. Between 5 and 50 grams, a Class B felony, punishable by up to 25 years in prison and a fine of up to $100,000. More than 50 grams, a Class B felony, punishable by up to 50 years in prison and a fine of up to $1 million. The bill also expands who can dispense naloxone, a medication that reverses the effects of an overdose. The changes will allow law enforcement, emergency rooms, and schools to get it into the hands of those who need it most, Reynolds said. The law passed with mostly bipartisan support in the legislature this year, but some Democrats opposed the law. They argued increasing penalties does not work in reducing criminal activity, and the bill did not do enough to prioritize treatment of substance use disorders. Democratic Representative Megan Srinivas, a doctor from Des Moines, proposed an amendment to the bill that would have legalized fentanyl test strips, which can be used to test for the presence of fentanyl in a pill or other drug. Reynolds said she does not think fentanyl test strips should be part of the solution to the rising opioid death rates. That's not something that I pushed in my bill because I don't believe that that has an appropriate place, she said. Reynolds also took aim at Democratic President Joe Biden's administration, whose border policy she said are to blame for the increase in fentanyl coming across the southern border. President Biden has a constitutional responsibility to secure our nation's border from illegal immigration and drug trafficking, human trafficking, and everything that's taking place on the southern border, she said. His failure to empower criminals is empowering the cartel who trade others' lives for profit. Ernst introduces the bill. Around the same time, that's a subtitle, Reynolds signed the new law. Iowa Republican U.S. Senator Joni Ernst announced plans to introduce a bipartisan bicameral bill with Virginia Democrat U.S. Senator Tim Kaine that would direct the Department of Defense to take stronger action against Mexican cartels and transnational criminal organizations trafficking fentanyl. Both Ernst and Kaine serve on the Senate Armed Services Committee. I'm using my oversight authority of the Department of Defense to stem the fentanyl crisis at its source, Ernst told reporters. The Disrupt Fentanyl Trafficking Act would classify fentanyl trafficking as a national security threat to provide a response proportional to the problem, Ernst said during a conference call with reporters. It would require the Pentagon to develop a fentanyl-specific counter-drug strategy, including working directly with the Mexican military and increasing security operations with Mexico to combat the fentanyl drug trade and disrupt Mexican cartel activity. The bill also seeks to address and better coordinate efforts between the military and federal law enforcement agencies. The DOD plays a leading role in the nation's counter-drug intelligence and monitoring operations, Ernst said. However, the lack of interagency cooperation over classification and inadequate resources have hampered our government's counter-fentanyl efforts. Fentanyl has become a leading cause of death in U.S. adults between the ages of 18 and 45. President Joe Biden, in his State of the Union address earlier this year, vowed to do more to tackle the epidemic. The amount of lives lost in Iowa and across the country due to this deadly drug has far surpassed the federal government's response, and we must scale immediately to combat this national security threat, Ernst said in a statement following her news conference. This bipartisan work will engage Mexico as an active partner to counter fentanyl's trafficking and put the Pentagon's tools to use to save American lives. Ernst met with Mexican officials at the Mexican embassy during a visit to Mexico City and the San Diego-Mexican border back in February as part of a congressional delegation that included Iowa Republican U.S. Reps Randy Fenstra and Marionette Miller Meeks. She said the crisis will only get worse with the expiration of the COVID-era policy that allowed, known as Title 42, that allowed U.S. authorities to quickly expel migrants on public health grounds. Republican lambasters have lambasted President Joe Biden and his administration's handling of a historic influx of illegal border crossings. They say has allowed fentanyl to be smuggled into the U.S. at higher rates and fueled the opioid crisis. Biden initially kept Title 42 in place after he took office, then tried to end its use in 2022. Republicans sued, arguing the restrictions were necessary for border security. Courts had kept the rules in place, but with the end of a national COVID-19 emergencies, the border restrictions have now gone away. The federal government, however, is putting new restrictions into place at its southern border to try to stop migrants from crossing illegally and encourage them instead to apply for asylum. Encourage them instead to apply for asylum online through a new process. The White House earlier this month announced the Pentagon is sending 1,500 troops to support U.S. Customs and Border Patrol and a counter-smuggling operation in the Darien Gap. The U.S. Department of Homeland Security is expanding detention capacity and deploying more resources and technology to support border communities, including hundreds more asylum officers and immigration judges to process migrants, according to the White House. While most fentanyl is smuggled into the United States along the southern border, the vast majority of fentanyl seizures along the border have been at legal U.S. ports of entry, according to the Drug Enforcement Agency. Fentanyl is rarely carried over the border through the desert, but is rather smuggled across official border crossings in passenger vehicles with concealed compartments or commingled with legitimate goods on tractor trailers, according to the DEA. And I do have separate efforts where I'm pushing the administration on greater resources so that we can interdict the fentanyl that's coming in through the ports of entry, Ernst said. But we do know that a number of migrants will also bring fentanyl into the country in between those ports of entry, and that there will be more people coming in unfettered with the end of Title 42. Sergeant Nick Nolte of the Cedar Rapids Police Department's Narcotics Division said over the last 2 months, the department has seized more than 4,000 fentanyl-laced fake prescription pills. And just this week, we had two more overdoses, Nolte said. Both people admitted to taking counterfeit pills, but would not cooperate with us. And that continues to be a problem here in Cedar Rapids. Just cooperation from the people to allow us to try to find the source of the supply. And now some of the national and world news. Biden, in quotes, America will not default. President says he's confident of budget deal with lawmakers. Washington, an optimistic President Joe Biden declared Wednesday he is confident the U.S. will avoid an unprecedented and potentially catastrophic debt default, saying talks with congressional Republicans have been productive. Biden said there's work to do on the global stage as he headed to Japan to consult with allies on Russia's invasion of Ukraine and China's assertiveness in the Pacific at the same time that the debt limit standoff looms at home. Biden's upbeat remarks came as a select group of negotiators began meeting to try and hammer out the final contours of a budget spending deal to unlock a path for raising the debt limit as soon as June 1st. That is when the Treasury Department says the U.S. could begin defaulting on its obligations and trigger financial chaos. I'm confident that we'll get the agreement on the budget and America will not default, Biden said at the White House. Democrat Biden and Republican House Speaker Kevin McCarthy have traded blame for a debt ceiling impasse for weeks. But Biden said of the latest White House sessions with congressional leaders that everyone came to the meeting, I think, in good faith. McCarthy was upbeat, too, contending Biden gave ground. The president said the budget talks were still separate from the debt limit issue, but the speaker said Biden finally backed off his refusal to negotiate. Biden said he would be in constant contact with the White House officials while at the summit in Hiroshima. The president departed Washington aboard Air Force One a day after scrapping plans for a historic stop in Papua New Guinea and a key visit to Australia amid the showdown with the House Republicans over raising the debt limit. The three-nation trip was meant as a triumph global leadership showcase and instead threatened to become a truncated reminder of how partisan disagreements have undercut U.S. standing on the global stage. I've cut my trip short in order to be here for the final negotiations and sign the deal with the majority leader, Biden said in remarks before departing the White House. I've made clear America is not a deadbeat nation. We pay our bills. For Biden, the intertwined dynamics of the debt standoff and his foray abroad put a spotlight on two key aspects of his presidency: his efforts to assert U.S. prowess on the international stage and to address economic concerns at home. They also are playing out as Biden is in the early weeks of his candidacy for re-election, adding political overtones to the situation. Another article is about climate change. UN warns of threshold, likelihood higher that Earth will temporarily hit key warming point. There's a 2 out of 3 chance that the world will temporarily hit a key warming limit within the next 5 years, the United Nations Weather Agency said Wednesday. But it likely would only be a fleeting and less worrisome flirtation with the internationally agreed upon temperature threshold. Scientists expect a temporary burst of heat from El Niño, a naturally occurring weather phenomena, to supercharge human-caused warming from the burning of coal, oil, and gas to new heights. Temperatures are expected to then slip back down a bit. The World Meteorological Organization forecasts a 66% likelihood that between now and 2027, the globe will have a year that averages 1.5 degrees Celsius warmer than the mid-19th century. That number is critical because of the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement set a 1.5 degrees Celsius as a global guardrail in the atmospheric warming, with countries pledging to try to prevent that much long-term warming if possible. Scientists in the 2018 United Nations report said that going past that point would be drastically and dangerously different, with more death and destruction and damage to global ecosystems. It won't be this year, probably. Maybe it'll be next year or the year after, that a year averages 1.5 degrees Celsius warmer, said report lead author Leon Hermanson, a climate scientist at the United Kingdom's Met Office. But climate scientists said that what's likely to happen in the next 5 years isn't the same as failing the global goal. This report does not mean that we will permanently exceed the 1.5 centigrade Celsius level specified in the Paris Agreement, which refers to long-term warming over many years. However, However, WMO is sounding the alarm that we will breach the 1.5 centigrade level at a temporary basis with increasing frequency, WMO Secretary General Petraeus said in a statement. We haven't been able to limit the warming so far, and we're still moving in the wrong direction, Talas said at Wednesday news conference. Hermansen cautioned that a single year doesn't really mean anything. Scientists usually use 30-year averages. The world has been inching closer to the 1.5-degree threshold due to human-caused climate change for years. The temporary warming of this year's expected El Niño, which starts with a warming of the parts of the Central Pacific Ocean and then sloshes across the globe, makes it possible for us to see a single year exceeding 1.5 centigrade a full decade before the long-term average, said climate scientist Zeki Hausfather of the tech company Stripe and Berkeley Earth, who wasn't part of the WMO report. You are listening to the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I am your reader, Martha Avery. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, give us a call at 515-243-6833. And now we'll turn to today's obituaries, of which we have two. Marlis Jean Rage, November 9th, 1928 to May 16th, 2023. Marlis Jean Rage was born November 9th, 1928 on a farm northeast of Desart, the daughter of Frank and Viola Heckroff. She married John H. Rage on February 18, 1951, at the Presbyterian Church in Waterloo. He preceded her in death on June 9, 2015. Marlis passed away on May 16 at Sunrise Hill Care Center, Trier, at the age of 94. Marlis attended country school near Desart, starting at the age of 4. The family moved to rural LaPorte City, where she was placed in the first grade since there was no kindergarten at her new school. By starting school young and skipping a grade, she graduated from Orange High School at age 16 and graduated from Gates Business College a year later. After college, Marlis moved to Pomona, California, where, among other adventures, she learned to fly, but never completed enough solo hours to get her license. Prior to her marriage and beginning her career as an active farm wife, she worked at Abel's Cafe in LaPorte City and then various secretarial jobs in Waterloo. Camping and fishing trips were treasured times with her husband, children, and extended family. A favorite pastime in the early years was dancing with friends at the Electric Park Ballroom in Waterloo. In later years, she and John enjoyed travels in the States and Hawaii, as well as to Europe. She was an anchor of calm strength and mingled with compassion and understanding for others. The stories she shared of her early life were truly inspirational, instructive, and valuable to all of her family in living their daily lives. She was admired for her courage, patience, generous nature, and adventurous spirit. Marlis was involved in the Women's Circle and the Mary Martha Circle at the Zion Lutheran Church in Desart. She also was active with the Desart Women's Club and the board of the Norma Anders Public Library. She was preceded in death by her parents, husband, and two sons-in-laws, Clark Schoonover and Frank Tzriski. Marlis is survived by 4 children, Linda, Felix, in parentheses, Ravello of Larned, Kansas, Diana Schoonover of Austin, Arkansas, David Rage of Desart, Wayne Rage of Yates City, Illinois, and her brother Don Heckroff of LaPorte City. Other survivors included her 10 grandchildren, several great-grandchildren, nieces, and nephews. Visitation will be held Friday, May 19th from 4 to 6:30 p.m. at Zion Lutheran Church, 800 South Main Street, Desart. Funeral service will be held Saturday, May 20th at 10:30 a.m. at Zion Lutheran Church. The burial will be held at the Nagy Cemetery. Memorials may be directed to the Norma Anders Public Library or Lutheran Social Services in care of Overton Funeral Home, 707 Clark Street, Desart, Iowa, 52224. And the phone number is 319-476-7355. Condolences may be left at www.parrotandwoodsfh.com. The second obituary is for Phyllis Waters, Phyllis H. Waters, Waterloo. Phyllis H. Waters, 92, of Waterloo, died Saturday, May 13th at Parker Place Assisted Living and Memory Care, Parksburg. She was born August 3, 1930, in Ellsworth, Wisconsin, to August and Lynette Bunce Haberstich. Phyllis graduated from Waterloo West High School in 1947. She received her LPN licensing in 1965 from Waterloo School of Practical Nursing, and in 1976 earned her EMT certificate, which she eventually used to save two lives. She married Gordon E. Waters December 21st, 1947, in Waterloo. He preceded her in death November 28th, in 2003. She was an LPN for Dr. Seibert in his private practice for 11 years. Phyllis was a member of the Hagerman Baptist Church. She had been a member of the Burton Avenue Baptist Church, where she taught Sunday school for over 30 years, as well as other churches. Phyllis also conducted personal Bible studies. She enjoyed growing, canning, freezing, and pickling vegetables and decorating cakes. She looked forward to her Sleepy Hollow class reunions and annual Wyoming deer hunting trips and Ellsworth Polka festivals. Survived by daughters Margaret Marge Murders, Burlington, Iowa, Elsie Nicholson, Sundance, Wyoming, and Rebecca Wagner, Waterloo, 6 grandchildren and 11 great-grandchildren. Preceded by 8 brothers, John, James, Daniel, Pat, Edwin, Glenn, and William Haberstich, and Robert and Raymond Harvester. 3 sisters, Elma Leeper, Ina Needig, and Mary Watterson Kelty. Visitation is from 4 to 6 p.m., Friday, May 19th, at Lockheed on 1519 West 4th Street in Waterloo. Funeral services are 1 p.m., Saturday, May 20th, at Hagerman Baptist Church and live streamed. The burial in the Garden of Memories Cemetery. And Memories to Sim Ministry Box Memorials, Memorials can be sent to Sim Ministry Box 7900, Charlotte, North Carolina, or the church. Condolences can be left at the lockfuneralservices.com. And now for some of the Cedar Valley news. Habitat celebrates new homeowner. Waterloo woman gets keys to an Allen Street home. Iowa Heartland Habitat for Humanity gifted another new homeowner with keys to her place on Tuesday through its home ownership program after revitalizing an older, dilapidated house in the 300 block of Allen Street. Raquel Harmon and her son, Stephen Meeks, age nine, plan to move in on Thursday. As an avid cooker, she's most looking forward to that first meal, lasagna. Home ownership has been the last goal on her list after having graduated from college, paid off her car loan, and gotten other debt under control. It's been a journey, the 2004 East High School graduate told a crowd that gathered inside the home to celebrate the accomplishment. I never thought I'd make it this far. I've always been on the outside looking in on everybody else's success. And I told God that I need to accomplish everything on that list now, and this was the last thing on the list. I couldn't have done it without all my family, the prayers, the push, the encouragement, and the matriarch, her grandmother, Lucy Skolark. The two-story, 1,476-square-foot home was built in 1901 at the corner of West 2nd and Allen Street. Habitat for Humanity took over the abandoned residence from the city that had been owned by a hoarder and was in less than ideal shape. The city had gotten it through the 657A property policy process for housing eligible to be rehabilitated. This project is a metaphor for how we want to approach our neighborhood revitalization, said Andy Conger, Iowa Heartland's construction director. It's changed the way we look at a home. We assess it for what it has going for it, and we lift up the good. We've really given it a second chance at life, even though it had been forgotten and abandoned. We're restoring hope where hope might have been lost. Work on the house started in the fall. That goal of finding its inner beauty and not modernizing it too much by instead preserving the history and character of the home was reflected throughout the home with a kitchen, 3 bedrooms, and 1.5 bathrooms with hardwood floors and baby powder blue walls. Since 1990, close to 200 families have been given the gift of home ownership through Iowa Heartland Habitat for Humanity. The rehabilitated homes are bought for an affordable price with no interest mortgage to a person who becomes eligible. That person becomes eligible by initially putting in 100 hours of sweat equity and eventually 300 hours total. Most of the time is spent working on the house of their dreams. Remaining hours are spent on other housing projects, taking home ownership classes, or volunteering at Iowa Heartland Habitat for Humanity Restore. The process typically takes about 18 to 24 months. For Harmon, that started in the fall of 2021. 15 to 20 other people are working through the program in hopes of purchasing their first home with the help of many volunteers and funding. A lot of what comes with the help of big organizations like John Deere. Harmon's 84-year-old grandmother was in attendance along with the other family, partners, and volunteers who presented gifts and mementos to the new homeowner. Others came as well who had joined in the process of helping make Harmon's dream a reality. I'm most excited to see my new room, said Meeks with a bunch of gifts in his hands he'd received as part of the ceremony. Iowa Heartland Habitat for Humanity has taken on other projects in the Church Row and Walnut neighborhoods, as well as in Cedar Falls, Waverly, and throughout Blackhawk, Bremer, Butler, and Buchanan counties. Fishing team catches big haul at tournament. Cedar Falls. The Cedar Falls High School fishing team started a little over a year ago with 3 dads trying to get kids involved in the hobby. Today it is 32 members strong with statewide championships under its belt. On Saturday, Cedar Falls joined 17 other schools at the Iowa Bass Team Companionship at Lake McBride in Johnson County, winning its second title in a row. Of the 49 boats on the lake, Cedar Falls contributed 11. According to the head coach, Carter Moore, Cedar Falls took first place for individual boats, teams, and for catching the biggest fish of the day, a 4.51-pound largemouth bass caught by Moore's son, Cale. Earlier in the day, Cale had caught a 3-pounder by a tree. Later on, he tried his luck in that spot again, reeling in the prize fish using a whack-rigged Senko worm. I believe it was spawning, Cale said with a smile. It had quite a belly on it. Together with his partner, fellow freshman Gavin Burkhardt, Cale's boat had a total haul of 13.52 pounds, and the team's total weigh-in was over 21 pounds. To determine team scoring, the combined weights of the two most successful boats were tallied. According to Moore, the team has seen major growth since it started out with the fellow coaches T.J. Norton and Brian Burkhardt. We can't keep them off the river and out of the fishing ponds. They're submitting catches on their virtual app constantly, so they're just out there getting better, Moore said. And we've got really supportive boat captains. All of this is done volunteer-wise, and so it's fun to see it's not just in Cedar Falls, but that the growth across the state. For students hitting the lakes and streams, it's a chance to participate in an activity that lets them enjoy the outdoors without the rigors of a spring sport. All are welcome. I just like when the day is good and we're catching a lot of fish, and even when it's tough, you can learn a lot, Cale said. And spending time with friends and family and my dad, it just keeps me going. As the sport continues to grow, Moore said he hopes fishing will be sanctioned by the Iowa High School Athletic Association and the Iowa High School Girls Athletic Union. I think that would be pretty neat. I know we've watched that happen with girls wrestling, Moore said, but I would personally love to see that. I think it would be really neat for the state of Iowa. The tournament was hosted by Independence Junior Senior High School, whose team is coached by Todd Reed. Now for a little of the high school roundup in sports. Sailors, Tigers advance to state. Columbus makes 1A state team tournament for 41st straight time. Waterloo. Tuesday at the Burns Park Tennis Center, the Columbus Catholic girls tennis team qualified for the Class 1A state team tennis tournament for the 41st consecutive season. The Sailors blanked Dyke New Hartford 5-0 to advance, where Columbus will face Decorah Saturday at 9 a.m. in Independence in a first-round match. The winner advances to the Final Four, which will be played on May 30th at Waukee Northwest High School. On Tuesday, the Sailors got a 6-0 wins by Sophia Fain and Allie Hagness at number 1 and number 2 singles to kick things off. Columbus also got wins from Kate Holton, 6-4, 6-1 over Izzy Norton at number 4, and Isabel Nelson over Anna Fram, 6-2, 6-3 at number 5, and Rachel Holland at number 6 also won. Avery Hogan's match at number 3 against L.A. Nock was finished after Columbus had sealed the win. In Iowa City, Cedar Falls captured a Class 2A Region 3 win over Iowa City Liberty to advance to the 2A state tournament. After the two teams split the 6 singles match, the Tigers won the first doubles matches to clinch the win. Maya Malavarapo and Madison Sagers won 6-1, 6-1 over Ella Gilbert and Sarah Rowe and number 1 doubles. And Francisca Schlaker and Nadia Patel topped Orion Bloom and Lainey Robbins 6-2, 6-3 at number 3. There were two tremendous singles matches that both went to the Tigers. Malavarupa opened her match with Gilbert with a 6-4 win in the first set before dropping the second set 6-0, and she won set 3-10-3 to win the match. At number 6, Patel dropped the opening set 4-6 to Robbins before winning set 2 with 6-2, and then she took set 3 in the match 10-6. Cedar Falls will face Ankeny Centennial at the Prairie Ridge Tennis Complex in Ankeny Saturday at 9 a.m. In the first round match, the winner will advance to the Final Four on May 30th at Johnston. Baseball. Tigers drop 2. Cedar Falls dropped to 0-4 on the season after a pair of close losses to the Linmar and Mississippi Valley Conference baseball action Tuesday in Marion. The Lions took Game 1 in walk-off fashion, 6-5, and then held off a Tiger rally in the nightcap for a 5-3. In Game 1, Colin Coonrad went 2 for 3 with a triple and drove in 2 runs for Cedar Falls. Drew Grett was also 2 for 3 with a pair of doubles and runs batted in, and Peyton Marsh collected a pair of hits and scored twice. Cedar Falls led 4-2 after 4 innings, but Linmar scored once in the 5th, twice in the 6th to take a 5-4 lead, and then walked off in the bottom of the 7th for the win. In Game 2, Cedar Falls fell behind 5-0 after 3 innings, but rallied late, scoring once in the 5th and twice in the 6th. Tate Hermanson went 3-for-3 in number 9 battling slot, while Marsh, Hermanson, and Coonrad all drove in runs. Independence 10, Waverly Shell Rock 1. Luke Johnson collected 3 hits and 5 different players drove in runs as the Mustangs opened their 2023 season with a win. Samuel Hamilton drove in 2 while Corver Hupke, Johnson, Keegan Palmer, and Caden Kramer also drove in runs. Charles City 3, Algona 2. Caden Blunt and Malachi O'Brien combined to strike out 13 batters, and the Comets staved off a late rally for the victory. Charles City led 3-0 after 6.5 innings before the Bulldogs rallied in the bottom of the 7th. O'Brien, however, was able to close the door and earn the save. Comet right fielders Lincoln Jocelyn picked up 3 hits and drove in all 3 Charles City runs. So let's wrap up here with looking at Cedar Valley's 5-day forecast. Today, showers heavy with thunderstorms, wind south-southwest 10 to 20 miles an hour, and 81 degrees, high of 81. Tonight, more showers, heavy thunderstorms, wind northwest 8 to 16 miles an hour with a low of 51. On Friday, it's going to be breezy with clearing. Wind's going to be north-northwest 10 to 20 miles an hour, and the high will be 62 on Friday and 44 with a low of 44. On Saturday, we're sunny and pleasant and warmer. Wind north-northwest 6 to 12 miles an hour, 72 and 48. And Sunday, nice with sunshine. Wind northwest 4 to 8 miles an hour, 79 degrees with a low of 49. And Monday will be partly sunny and nice. Wind southeast 7 to 14 miles per hour, high of 78 and 55 degrees. That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier. I'm your reader, Martha Avery. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.
In Africa, 5-year-old Charu has no choice. She and millions like her must walk miles every day for dirty water. But together, we can end their walk by providing clean water close by. Instead of spending hours walking to get water that makes them sick, girls can be in a classroom that expands their minds, and moms will gain back time to care for their families. Sons and daughters can grow up strong, finally free of sicknesses caused by dirty water. At World Vision, care about clean water runs deep. Deep enough to reach one new person with clean water every 10 seconds. Because every child, every person, everywhere deserves clean water and a chance to rise to their full potential. It's true. When you just add water, you change a life. Learn more at worldvision.org.